Meanwhile, the Achaeans mourned all night long in lamentation for Patroclus. The son of Peleus led their loud lament, placing his murderous hands on the breast of his companion and groaning incessantly, like some great bearded lion whose cubs have been stolen from the thick wood where he left them by a man out hunting deer. The lion comes back too late and is filled with anguish, and ranges through many of the mountain hollows, tracking after the man's footsteps in the hope of finding him, and bitter fury grips him. So Achilleus, groaning heavily, spoke to the Myrmidons. Oh, it was an empty promise I made on that day when I was comforting the hero Menoetius in his house. I said that I would bring his son back to Apoeus in glory, that he would sack Ilios and come home with his share of the booty. But Zeus does not bring about all that men intend, and both of us are fated to redden the same earth here in Troy, as I shall not return home either to be welcomed in his house by the old horseman Peleus or my mother Thetis, but the earth will cover me here. But now, Patroclus, since I shall be going under the ground after you, I shall not give you burial until I have brought here the armour and head of Hector, the great man who murdered you. And at your pyre I shall cut the throats of 12 splendid Trojan children in my anger for your killing. But until then you will lie by my beaked ships as you are now, and deep-breasted Trojan and Dardanian women will keen for you with their tears falling day and night long. The women we worked hard to win with our own strength and our long spears when we were sacking the rich cities of mortal men. So speaking, godlike Achilleus called to his companions to set a great tripod over the fire, so they could wash the clotted blood from Patroclus without delay. They placed a three-legged cauldron on the burning fire, and poured water into it, and brought firewood to kindle under it. The fire worked on the belly of the cauldron, and the water warmed. Then, when the water had boiled in the gleaming bronze, they washed him and rubbed him thickly with oil, and filled his wounds with long-stored ointment. Then they placed him on a bier, and covered him from feet to head with a soft sheet of fine linen, and over that a white cloak. Then all night long the Myrmidons gathered round swift-footed Achilleus, and mourned in lamentation for Patroclus. And Zeus spoke to Hera, his sister and wife.
"So you have achieved it in the end, ox-eyed Queen Hera. You have stirred swift-footed Achilleus into action. It must be then that you are mother to all the long-haired Achaeans, and they your children."
Then the ox-eyed Queen Hera answered him, "Dread son of Cronos, what is this you are saying? Even men will achieve their purposes for other men, though they are mortal and without the knowledge that we have. How then, when my claim is to be the greatest of goddesses, for double reason, both by birth and because I am called your wife, and you are lord over all the immortals, how could I not weave trouble for the Trojans when they have angered me?" Such were their words to each other. Meanwhile, silver-footed Thetis came to the house of Hephaestus, that imperishable house of star-bright bronze, a shining sight for the immortals, which the cripple-foot god had made with his own hands. She found him busy at his bellows and sweating as he plied them. He was making a set of 20 tripods to stand along the wall of his strong-built house, and had fitted them with golden wheels under each leg, so he could have them moving of their own accord, running by themselves to where the gods were gathered, and then returning again to his house. A miraculous sight. They were so far finished, but the worked handles had not yet been added. He was fitting these and forging the rivets. While he was working at these, in the cunning of his craft, the silver-footed goddess Thetis came close. Charis came out of the house and saw her, the lovely shining-veiled goddess who was the wife of the famous lame god. She took her hand and spoke to her. "What is it, Thetis, fine-robed goddess, that has brought you to our house? You are honoured and loved here, but before now you have not visited us often. But come inside with me, and let me give you hospitality." So speaking, the queen among goddesses led her inside. She then sat her down on a beautiful chair, finely worked with silver studs, with a footstool underneath, and called to Hephaestus, the famous craftsman, and said, "Hephaestus, come out here. Thetis is here with a request for you." Then the famous lame god answered her, "Oh, then, a goddess I revere and honour is in our house. She saved me when I was in pain after the great fall brought on me by my own shameless mother, who wanted to hide me away because I was crippled. I would have suffered agonies at heart then if Thetis had not taken me in and welcomed me to her bosom. Thetis and Eurynome, the daughter of the circling stream of ocean. I lived with them for 9 years, crafting jewellery in abundance, brooches and curved bracelets, earrings and necklaces, down there in the hollow cave, surrounded by the foam and roar of ocean streaming endlessly on. And no one else among gods or mortal men knew of it, but only Thetis and Eurynome knew, as they had saved me. And now Thetis has come to our house, so I must do all that I can to repay lovely-haired Thetis the debt for my life. So you now set out fine food for our guest, while I put away my bellows and all my tools." So he spoke, and stood up from the anvil block, a monstrous size and limping, but his thin legs bustled quickly under him. He put the bellows away from the fire and gathered all the tools he had been working with into a silver box. Then he used a sponge to wipe over his face and both his hands, his massive neck and hairy chest. He put on a tunic, took up a thick stick to lean on, and went limping to the door, where his maids ran to help their master. "They are made of gold, looking like living girls. They have intelligent minds, and speech too, and strength, and have learnt their handiwork from the immortal gods." So they busied themselves in support of their master. He came stumbling close to where Thetis was seated, and sat down on a shining chair, and took her hand and spoke to her. "What is it, Thetis, fine-robed goddess, that has brought you to our house? You are honoured and loved here, but before now you have not visited us often. Say what is in your mind. My heart prompts me to do it if I can, and it is something possible." Then Thetis answered him, with her tears falling, "Hephaestus, is there any one of all the goddesses on Olympus who has endured such misery in her heart as all the sorrows that Zeus, son of Cronos, has given me beyond all others? Out of all the sea goddesses, he made me subject to a man, Peleus, son of Iacchus, and I had to serve a mortal's bed, though much against my will. Now he lies in his house, broken by painful old age. But there is more misery for me now. He gave me a son to bear and raise, to be the greatest of heroes, and he shot up like a young sapling. I tended him like a plant in the crown of a garden, and sent him out with the beaked ships to fight the Trojans. But now I shall never welcome him back to Peleus's house. There will be no homecoming. And yet, all the time I have him alive and looking on the light of the sun, he is suffering, and I can give him no help when I go to him. The girl that the sons of the Achaeans chose out as his prize, Lord Agamemnon took back out of his hands. So he let his heart waste away in grief for her. This is Briseis. And meanwhile, the Trojans penned the Achaeans back by the sterns of their ships and would not let them break out. The elders of the Argives came and pleaded with Achilles and named all the glorious gifts they would give him. Then he refused to go out himself to beat disaster from them, but he dressed Patroclus in his own armour and sent him out to war and a large force to go with him. All day long they fought around the Scaean gates, and they would have sacked the city on that very day if Apollo had not killed the brave son of Menoetius in the front ranks after he had done much damage, and he gave the glory to Hector. So that is why I have come to beg at your knees, hoping that you will give my doomed son a shield and a fine pair of greaves fitted with ankle pieces, and a corselet. The armour he had was lost with his trusted friend when he fell to the Trojans, and now my son is lying on the ground in agony of heart. Then the famous lame god answered her, "Do not worry, do not let your heart be concerned about this. If only I could be as certain of hiding him away from grim death when his cruel fate comes on him, as I am that there will be beautiful armour for him now, such that all the many men who see it will marvel at the sight." So speaking, he left Thetis where she was and went back to his bellows. He turned them to the fire and ordered them to set to work. There were 20 bellows in all, and they began blowing on the crucibles, sending out a good blast at every strength he needed, ready to give their help when he was busy, and ready again to blow in whatever way suited Hephaestus's wish and the progress of the work. He threw unwearying bronze on the fire, and tin and precious gold and silver. Then he set the great anvil on the anvil block, and gripped a mighty hammer in one hand and fire tongs in the other. First, he began to make a huge and massive shield, decorating it all over. He put a triple rim round its edge, bright and gleaming, and hung a silver baldric from it. The body of the shield was made of 5 layers, and on its face he elaborated many designs in the cunning of his craft. On it he made the earth and sky and sea, the weariless sun and the moon waxing full, and all the constellations that crown the heavens, Pleiades and Hyades, the mighty Orion and the Bear, which men also call by the name of Wain. She wheels round in the same place, and watches for Orion, and is the only one not to bathe in ocean. And on it he made 2 fine cities of mortal men. In one there were marriages and feasting, and they were escorting the brides from their houses through the streets under the light of burning torches, and the wedding song rose loud. The young men were whirling in the dance, and among them reed flutes and lyres kept up their music, while the women all stood at the doors of their houses and looked on, admiring. The men had gathered in the marketplace where a quarrel was in progress. Two men quarrelling over the blood money for a man who had been killed. One claimed that he was making full compensation and was showing it to the people, but the other refused to accept any payment. Both were eager to take a decision from an arbitrator. The people were taking sides and shouting their support for either man, while the heralds tried to keep them in check. And the elders sat on the polished stone seats in the sacred circle, taking the rod in their hands as they received it from the loud-voiced heralds. Then each would stand forward with the rod and give his judgment in turn. And 2 talents of gold lay on the ground in the middle of the circle, to be given to the one who spoke the straightest judgment. The other city had 2 encamped armies surrounding it, their weapons glittering. There was debate among them, with support for either view, whether to storm the city and sack it, or to agree with the inhabitants a division of their property, taking half of all the possessions contained in the lovely town. But the defenders were not ready to yield, and had secretly armed for an ambush. Their dear wives and young children, and the men overtaken by old age, stood on the walls to defend them, while the others set out. They were led by Ares and Pallas Athene, both shone in gold, and dressed in golden clothing, huge and beautiful in their armour, and standing out as God's will, clear above the rest, and the people with them were of smaller size. When they reached the place that suited their ambush down by a river, where all the cattle came to water, they took up their position there, covered in shining bronze. Then 2 scouts were posted at a distance from the main body, to wait for sight of the sheep and twist-horned cattle. Soon they appeared, and with them 2 herdsmen playing on their pipes, with no thought for danger. The men in ambush saw them coming and rushed out on them, then quickly surrounded the herds of cattle and fine flocks of white-wooled sheep, and killed the shepherds with them. But when the besiegers heard the great commotion among their cattle, from where they sat in their assembly place, they immediately mounted behind their high-stepping horses and went in pursuit, and quickly overtook them. Then they formed for battle, and fought it out by the banks of the river, casting at each other with their bronze-tipped spears. And strife and confusion were in their company, and cruel death. She gripped one man alive with a fresh wound on him, and another one unwounded, and was dragging a dead man by the feet through the shambles. The cloak on her shoulders was deep red with men's blood. The figures closed and fought like living men, and dragged away from each other the bodies of those who were killed. And he made on it a field of soft fallow, rich ploughland, broad and triple-tilled. There were many ploughmen on it, wheeling their teams and driving this way and that. Whenever they had turned and reached the headland of the field, a man would come forward and put a cup of honey-sweet wine in their hands. Then they would turn back down the furrows, pressing on through the deep fallow to reach the headland again. The field darkened behind them and looked like earth that is ploughed, though it was made in gold. This was the marvel of his craftsmanship. And he made on it a king's estate of choice land, where workers were reaping the corn with sharp sickles in their hands. The crop fell to the ground in handful after handful along the swathe, while binders tied the cut tresses into sheaves with twine. There were 3 sheaf binders standing ready, and boys working behind the reapers kept them constantly supplied, gathering the cut corn and bringing it in armfuls to them. and among them the king, holding his sceptre, stood quietly by the swathe, with delight in his heart. To one side his heralds were preparing a feast under an oak, busy with a great ox they had slaughtered, and the women were pouring out an abundance of white barley for the workers' meal. And he bade on it a vineyard heavy with grapes, a beautiful thing made in gold. But the clusters on the vines were dark, and the rows of poles supporting them were silver. And all around the plot he set a ditch worked in blue enamel and a fence of tin. A single path led into the vineyard, and along it went the pickers at the time of the grape harvest. Girls and young men, innocent-hearted, were carrying out the honey-sweet crop in woven baskets. In their midst, a boy was playing a lovely tune on a clear-sounding lyre, and to it sweetly singing the Linus song in his delicate voice. They followed him with singing and shouting, and danced behind him with their feet beating time to his music. And he bade on it a herd of straight-horned cattle. The cows were fashioned in gold and tin, and were mooing as they hurried from the farmyard to their pasture, by a purling river, beside the beds of swaying reeds. Four herdsmen in gold walked along with the cattle, and there were nine quick-footed dogs accompanying them. But at the head of the cattle, two fearsome lions had caught a bellowing bull, and he was dragged away, roaring loud. The dogs and the young men went after him. The lions had broken open the great ox's hide and were gulping its inwards and black blood. The herdsmen could only set their quick dogs at them and urge them on. The dogs would always turn back before biting the lions, but they stood close and barked at them while keeping clear. And the famous lame god made on it a great pasture ground for white-walled sheep in a beautiful valley with steadings and covered huts and sheepfolds. And the famous lame god elaborated a dancing floor on it, like the dancing floor which once Daedalus built in the broad space of Knossos for lovely-haired Ariadne. On it there were dancing young men and girls whose marriage would win many oxen, holding each other's hands at the wrist. The girls wore dresses of fine linen, and the men closely woven tunics with a light sheen of olive oil. And the girls had beautiful garlands on their heads, and the men wore golden daggers hanging from belts of silver. At times they would run round on their skilful feet very lightly, as when a potter sits to a wheel that fits comfortably in his hands and tries it, to see if it will spin smoothly. And then they would form lines and run to meet each other. A large crowd stood round enjoying the sight of the lovely dance, and two acrobats among the performers led their dancing, whirling and tumbling at the centre. And he made on it the mighty river of ocean, running on the rim round the edge of the strong-built shield. Then, when he had finished the huge and massive shield, he made him a corselet, brighter than the light of burning fire, and he made him a heavy helmet to fit close round his temples, a beautiful, finely worked thing, and he added a golden crest on top, and he made him greaves of fine beaten tin. Then, when the famous lame god had worked all the armour, he took it up and laid it before Thetis, the mother of Achilles. And she plunged down like a hawk from snowy Olympus, carrying with her the glittering armour from Hephaestus.